This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. Neil Conan is away. April 6th, 12 years ago, the private plane of the Rwandan president was shot down over Kigali, the capital. Just hours later, the slaughter began. At the end of 100 days, 800,000 people were dead, and the silence from the international community was deafening. Paul Rusesabagina was one of those who watched Rwanda descend into madness, but he did not stand by in silence. As the manager of Rwanda's four-star luxury Mill Collines, he transformed the hotel into a haven for refugees, standing between 1,200 people and all but certain slaughter. He never planned to make his story public, but he became an international celebrity after his story was dramatized in the widely acclaimed film Hotel Rwanda. Now he tells his story himself. His autobiography was released last week. It's called An Ordinary Man. Paul Rusesabagina is with me for the hour today in Studio 3A. It's an honor to have you here. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We'd like to hear from you this hour, particularly those of you who are from Rwanda or who have lived or worked in Rwanda. If you have questions for Paul Rusesabagina, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And Mr. Rusesabagina, I have to confess to you that I carried your book around in my bag for weeks. And I did that because I just, you know, I did not go to Rwanda, but I know many people who did, who covered the story. I watched the story closely, and I just did not want to relive those memories. And I know that reliving it from a distance is not at all the same as living through it. But I wanted to ask you, was it hard to write this book because you had to relive them?
Definitely, writing this book was very hard for me because it recalls always what we went through. You know that whenever we think about the Rwandan genocide, everything is always fresh in mind, as if it was happening yesterday.
And did you hesitate to do it, or did you feel that you had to?
I never hesitated. I only didn't want to talk about myself right from the beginning in 1994. I wanted other people to do it, first of all. And this is what happened with Hotel Rwanda.
How did your story become public?
Immediately after the genocide, all of those people who were not there to witness what was going on during the genocide, they came in as NGOs, as book writers, as journalists. And all of them were very much surprised to notice that Mill Collines Hotel was the only place where many people were hiding and no one from the beginning to the end was killed. No one was taken out to be killed outside or even beaten in the hotel. So from the beginning to the end, I had 1,268 people and they all of them went out safe.
And many of those people then told people what had happened. And so that's how they came to you?
They actually were surprised and then referred to me by the hotel employees and many Mill Collines survivors who just were saying how they survived. Then in most other books talking about the Rwandan genocide, you will see my name and a lot of stories from the Mill Collines Hotel.
Yes, your book is very helpful in understanding this conflict, which is still very hard to understand. But one of the things you explain is how the conflict between the Hutus and the Tutsis began. And it is described as either a racial conflict or an intertribal conflict. Is that really true?
Actually, that conflict is rooted in our history. It is starting a long time before the colonization, when Hutus were actually slaves to Tutsis. And when colonizers came in late 1800s, they took Tutsis to be more intelligent, to be more closer to Europeans, to be made to be leaders, whereas Hutus were supposed to work land. And they used Tutsis to oppress Hutus until 1959 during the Hutu Revolution, which was unfortunately a Hutu revolution and not a national revolution. What I mean by a national revolution is a Hutu and Tutsi revolution all together to get rid of the colonizers. So our countrymen also had to leave the country because for about 60 years they had been partners to colonizers. So they were also kicked out of their country. In that time, about 250,000 Rwandans fled the country and went to neighboring countries.
So the oppressed,
as refugees.
The oppressed became the oppressor.
The oppressed became the oppressor.
Can I, as an outsider, tell people apart? Are these differences as distinct as they are experienced in Rwanda to an outsider?
Actually, to an outsider, maybe many years ago, you could see and say that this one is a Hutu, the other one is a Tutsi. But today, many people look alike. People have been mixing through centuries. And today, people, you can know who is a Hutu, who is a Tutsi. Almost all of us, we are mixed.
In fact, your mother is Tutsi.
My mother
was
a Tutsi.
Well,
and my father was a Hutu.
Well, why then were you not considered Tutsi?
Because in Rwanda, we follow the father's lines. So I was a Hutu because my father was a Hutu.
And you tell a story in your book of a friend of yours, a childhood friend of yours, who had the same mixture but the opposite, that his father was Tutsi and his mother was Hutu. Your friend
Gerard.
Gerard. What happened to Gerard as a result of the fact that slight difference made all the difference?
Gerald was kicked out of the school. He went to work land just like any peasant, and he started selling the banana beers, and until a time when he got a job in a people's bank, where he worked as a small clerk throughout his life. I used to talk to him. He had ambitions, he had goals and objectives, but that time being kicked out of school in Rwanda meant the end of life, almost.
And that sort of discrimination, was it legal? I mean, was permitted, tolerated, accepted?
Actually, it was accepted at that time. Because being kicked out of a school meant the loss of everything. Because one school was just meant for a student. There were so few schools. About only 2% of the children were going to the secondary school. So the chances were not so many. And being reinstalled in another school, it was almost impossible.
Let's talk to a caller now. Let's go to Roanoke, Virginia. And Brian. Welcome, Brian.
Yes ma'am. My Rwanda name is actually Rubaduka, which is what I prefer, but I'll go by Brian.
Well, what's on your mind, Brian?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been a teacher in Rwanda, and I'm engaged to a Rwandan. So, I don't know, I had the opportunity to teach at the Prime Minister's office out there in Rwanda up until recently, but I've been back for a couple months. I have two questions. The first question concerns the French involvement in the genocide and a recent story that just came out about that. The second question deals with how here in the West, the Western media tend to repeat the old myths about the Hutus and the Tutsis without going back to the primary sources to try to figure out where these myths came from in the first place. But if I can get to my first question.
Well, no, actually, Brian, I think that let's stick with the second question here. And to hone in on it, you're saying what? That you don't think that in the West it is well understood that the origin of these ethnic differences is what?
Well, how could it be easily understood? Because mm-hmm. in one region, the definition means one thing. In another region, it's something else. At one time period, it means one thing. At another time period, it means something else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They had Belgian colonists measuring the width of people's noses to determine, you know, whether it's a Tutsi or Hutu. If you had a wide nose, you're a Hutu. If you had a narrow nose, you're a Tutsi. At another point, it depends on how many cows you have. If you have more than 10 cows, you're a Tutsi. If you have less than 10 cows, you're a Hutu. Okay. So, I mean, the definition changes from time to time and from place to place. So how could you possibly understand it or easily summarize it?
Okay. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate that. Thank you. Is that so?
That is very much so. Before colonization, the king could take many Tutsis who were not responding to his duties and obligation, and call them Hutus, take all their cows, because the wealth in Rwanda was always measured in terms of cows. And also when colonizers also made it again worse, when they started measuring noses, taking some Hutus as Tutsis, and some, because they had rather thin noses, and taking some Tutsis as Hutus because they had wide and short noses. That is, at a given time, the argument of Hutu and Tutsi became just meaningless.
What I'm trying to understand is, were those distinctions original to the country before the Europeans arrived, and did the Europeans exploit them? Or were these imposed from outside as a way to create conflict among the population to make it easier to control?
There was a difference between Hutus and Tutsis before colonization. Because a Hutu, what does a Hutu mean? A Hutu means someone who works for another. It meant at that time someone who was just like a slave. A Hutu was working for a Tutsi.
Why do you think that you, your father particularly, and you also, who were married to a Tutsi, why do you think that this kind of racial consciousness did not infect your family?
Well, I think that was because of my father and mother. My parents were above the racial, the ethnic problems. They went above everything.
We're talking with Paul Rusesabagina. His book is called No Ordinary Man, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. We're honored to have as our guest today Paul Rusesabagina. He's the hotel manager who saved 1,200 of his countrymen who sought refuge in his hotel. His story inspired the Oscar-nominated movie Hotel Rwanda. You can read an excerpt from his autobiography, No Ordinary Man, at our website, npr.org. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Mr. Rusesabagina, your father sounds like an extraordinary person. You talk about the 1959 rebellion, and all of a sudden, you know, all these people show up at your house. And what was that like for you?
In 1959, I was a young boy who was 5 years old. I saw many houses being burned, and I was even asking my parents what was happening. They told me that bad people had come. Why were other people coming to our house? I knew, but they told me that something has happened in Kigali. Many things were happening around us, and those people had made a choice to come to our house to stay with us for a few days. So that is how it was. But my father, he was a gentleman. He was someone who was between Hutus and Tutsis, but also very strict, correct, and I admired his sense of justice.
Were you scared, though, when all these people showed up at your house and you had to sleep outside?
I was a child. I really didn't care. And whenever my father was around, just like in children, I felt protected.
Do you think that his decision to shelter these refugees affected you later on?
Maybe it did. Because later on, I happened to learn what was going on that time.
And how did you talk to your own children about the racial differences in Rwanda? How did you talk to them about where they fit into the firmament and how they should think about that?
To go about that, talking with examples is always the best solution. But we also, at a given time, had to sit down and talk about it. But with examples, Hutus and Tutsis have ever been coming to my house, just sharing whatever we had, Each and every year, on the New Year Eve, many people, Hutus and Tutsis, all together, come to my house. We celebrate for the whole night until the following day. So my children are used to both Hutus and Tutsis.
In the days before the massacre began, did you have a sense that something was going to happen? Did you and other people have a sense that something was about to happen?
We were all of us sensing something. Since 1993, when we saw that about a million people were surrounding Kigali, fleeing the zones occupied by the rebels, because the rebels also were killing civilians on their way to Kigali, and all the zones behind them were just empty. So by that time, 1993, many people were surrounding Kigali, coming to beg in town, going to sleep in the open air, under the sun, under the dust, under the rain, without food, without water, without shelter, just dying every day of natural catastrophes in camps.
You had just been in Belgium for a training exercise or an experience or something just a couple of weeks before the massacres happened. Did it ever occur to you not to come back?
Well, I was in Belgium in a manager's meeting. I was in March 1994. That was a month before the genocide broke out. And then after my manager's meeting, I had a vacation. I had taken my wife and my younger son, who is now 13 years old, almost 14. We did a tour until March 31st, a Thursday morning. That is when we landed in Kigali. And instead of going to the hotel where we had been staying for months, we went to our house because we trusted the international community. We believed in the UN peacekeepers. We thought that they were peacekeepers. We never knew that they were there to run away when things would become tough. And even the few ones who remained there, about 260 soldiers, were not keeping peace. They were just observing, in UN uniforms, without any weapon, without even defending a civilian.
When did it become clear that the United Nations was not going to step in, that they were not going to stop this, that no international outside force was going to stop this?
Already on day one, that was on April the 7th, when the 10 Belgian soldiers were massacred by the army. Those were bodyguards to the Prime Minister. When they were massacred, Belgium decided to pull out, backed by the United Kingdom, the United States, the whole of the international community decided to pull out, to take out more than 2,000 soldiers and leave us with 200 and a few more.
And can you describe what the moment was like for you when you realized the massacres were occurring? And what, you had your family. Did you think about just leaving the country? What was going through your mind? I know you made the decision to take your family to the hotel, but then what?
Well, I did not really have an opportunity to think about leaving the country with my wife and my children, because already from my house, on day one, we saw our neighbors, most of them in military uniforms, others in militia uniforms. We couldn't believe our eyes. Many of our neighbors were killed the same morning, the very same morning of day one. And then all those who were not killed and not killing came to my house. By the end of the day, we had 26 foreigners, strangers, who were staying with us. So even when I got an opportunity to leave my house and go to the hotel, when the interim government decided to get settled in my hotel, the diplomat hotel, and they sent soldiers to come and evacuate me, I had to take my neighbors who were also in my house.
You didn't have to.
Well, I had to, because my own conscience was to my own advisor. I called my conscience my advisor. My advisor was telling me that, listen, do not leave these people behind. If you do and they are killed, you will never be a free man. You'll be a prisoner of yourself. You will never eat and feel satisfied. You will never drink and feel satisfied. Don't leave them behind. This is an opportunity.
Why do you think that you were able to make that decision and so many other people were not? I mean, educated people. This was not simply, you know, ragamuffins with nothing. There were, as you point out in your book, there were clergy who said nothing, who stood by. There were people who were radio announcers, the radio broadcasters were fomenting the genocide. Why do you think you were able to make the decision to spare life when other people who were similarly situated either stood by and or took life?
Actually, I was not opposite to what people say or think. I was not the only one who did that. There are so many other people who did the same. Because if there are Tutsis who survived, it was because of their neighbors, Hutus, who helped them to survive. And we thought simply that we were doing the right thing. We thought we were sure that we were doing the right thing from the beginning to the end. And many of those ones were even killed protecting their neighbors.
Let's go to, I think it's Devor, California. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing this. Let's go to Dustin.
Hello.
Hello, Dustin.
Hi, Paul. Very nice to speak to you today. I want to first thank you for your contribution to humanity, because people like you really make the world that I live in a better place, and I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you.
My question is, you know, I'm a journalist, and I haven't seen some tragedy, not on anywhere near the scale that you were exposed to, but you know, the things that I've seen have left a feeling of fear and terror in me that comes to the surface sometimes, and I wanted to know, for you, with the scope of the tragedy you witnessed, how, as an ordinary man, how has that affected your spirit, and how does that impact, you know, your life day to day? Because I can't even imagine putting myself in that situation. I think it would break me down.
That has really affected my day-to-day life. Before that, running genocide, I used to be a very cheerful guy. I could go to a bar, even pay rounds to other people who were in the bar, just smiling, laughing, talking to each and everyone. But since the genocide, I never went back to any bar. I suspect each and every human being, and my belief also has been affected. Just like many Rwandans, before the genocide, we used to say that God could wander all around the world and make sure to come to sleep in Rwanda. But during the genocide, we were asking God, but God, where are you? Where have you gone? You have abandoned a whole nation. And afterwards, even now, many people have been affected by what we have seen. We do no more trust any human being. A human being to us is more or less like a shark, just sleeping, lying on the bottom of a sea, which can emerge anytime and break a lot of boats.
Thank you, Dustin. It's a very personal question, Mr. Rusesabagina, but have you lost your faith as a result of what you saw and lived through?
Not really. I not really lost my faith, because I believe that no one will die before the hour, before the day, even the minute. Each and everyone has got a time on the earth. And even if people, if Rwandans were not going to kill Rwandans, they were going to die in another way.
But how then do you make sense of what happened?
Well, actually, it doesn't really make sense, but we have to find a sense, to have to find a solution somewhere.
But atrocities you describe in the book is the one that I think we all confront, and it is the atrocity of silence. And you've previously described the UN as not only useless, but worse than useless, in some ways a negative presence. Would you talk more about that?
Well, I believe that the United Nations have kept quiet, silent. And silence is an agreement or complicity. So the UN, since the UN never did anything. They simply turned backs, closed ears and eyes, and didn't want to see, didn't want to take responsibilities. During the Rwandan genocide, when the UN left, it was a clear message sent to killers, telling them that, listen, you guys, you are stronger than us. Telling the killers that you are stronger than us. Go ahead, do your job. We have failed. We can't face you. So that was a message that encouraged killers much more, or to kill many more than earlier. That time, when the UN just turned back and ran away. We saw priests killing their church members. Church members killing priests. Husbands killing wives and wives killing husbands. We saw people killing people, piling dead bodies on the road, making roadblocks and drinking beers. We saw a lot of disasters in that country. And yet, many people who had fled their houses, had gathered in schools, had gathered in churches under the UN protection. But when they just decided to leave them, they simply left. And those people were just begging, telling them that, please, do take us with you. Because if you don't, these guys are going to kill us. So you can imagine seeing the United Nations evacuating all the foreigners, including their soldiers, the so-called peacekeepers, being evacuated, leaving victims on their own, abandoning actually victims. So how can you be in my part, in my side, and have faith and trust again the United Nations?
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Is it hard for you to travel to these world capitals? You've been a guest in many countries. Many people have received you, particularly in connection to the film, and to be feted and, you know, petted and given awards, and to look at these world leaders who could have intervened and failed to do so. Is that difficult?
Well, it is difficult. But again, if we want to play, if you want to play a role, if you want to play a game, you have to go to the field. Because if you don't go to the field, you'll be isolating yourself and you won't get anywhere. Becoming bitter, angry, just going in my own corner, it is possible. But is it the best solution? If you want to change things, you have to be there. So we also have to be there.
And one of the things that you've been active on is the question of Darfur. You've been an eloquent spokesperson on behalf of the Sudanese people who are caught between Arab militias and the rebel armies. Why have you decided to get involved in this conflict? One would think that you've seen quite enough.
I think that after the Rwandan genocide, I became a humanitarian. I became very much concerned by what is going on all around us. And then, as a humanitarian, I just recently traveled to Darfur with some congressmen and Don Cheadle, who was also the actor who played my role, and John Prendergast of the International Crisis Group. We went to see. I wanted to see what was going on in Darfur, and unfortunately, what was going on in Rwanda between 1990 and 1994 is exactly what has been going on in Darfur since 2003 up to now.
And do you feel that the international community has responded in any meaningful way? I mean, certainly many, I think more journalists have been writing about this than the situation in Rwanda. It's gotten high-level attention from some of our, you know, major publications. But do you see anything different in the response?
Unfortunately, history keeps on repeating itself and does never teach us any lessons. What was going on in Rwanda is what is going on in Darfur. The whole world stood by for the Rwandan case, and even today, the whole world is again standing by, watching, and doesn't do anything to help those victims.
Is there anything that gives you cause for hope that these spasms of violence that we experience around the world will cease, or that the international community will somehow involve itself before so much life is lost? Is there anything that keeps you? What keeps you hopeful? Surely something must, or you wouldn't be able to visit with us today.
Definitely. I still have hope. I believe in the people. I believe in the power of you and I changing things. We vote for our leaders in the West especially. So we believe that our leaders in the West are going to change things. What I heard this morning is that the U.S. administration was trying now to get the NATO more involved in what is going on in Darfur. So I believe in a better future for the Darfurians, in a difference, which is the difference of what was going on in Rwanda in 1994.
When we come back from a short break, we'll have more about Rwanda and Darfur with Paul Rusesabagina. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're talking with Paul Rusesabagina, the hotel manager who risked his life to save 1,200 Tutsis and moderate Hutus from slaughter during the genocide that raged in Rwanda 12 years ago. You can read an excerpt from Paul Rusesabagina's autobiography, An Ordinary Man, at our website, npr.org. Please join us if you have questions about Rwanda or for Paul Rusesabagina at 800-989-TALK. Actually, let's go to a caller. Let's go to Oregon and to Kanzo. Are you there?
Good afternoon, Brother Paul.
Good afternoon.
I was born in Khartoum, Sudan. Mm-hmm. And my question is, with all the devastation and suffering that Africa has faced, whether it's Rwanda, Sudan, you name it, every nation must have, from epidemics, AIDS, to ethnic cleansing. When the world looked the other way, but 1990, the 1 million soldiers rally to liberate the Kurds in North Iraq because they have the oil. Is that this the case, that Iraq is left alone to devastation because there isn't enough oil?
What do you say? Do you understand the question?
Well, I think that is a rather political question. And I really don't want to get involve the ordinary men in a deep political business.
Do you see an end to the ethnic cleansing and tribal devastation, at least in Africa?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Kanzo. Thank you for joining us. What is the situation in Rwanda now?
Unfortunately, after the genocide, killings never ended. Many people were being tied from the back, beaten to death. Others were tied and thrown in containers. You can imagine how a container can be hot daytime and cold in the night. And then many died like that, burnt, and their ashes thrown in the forests. Many others were gathered and locked into houses, and oil was poured on the houses, and they were burnt alive. A refugee camp in 1995 was completely destroyed by government helicopters and machine guns, and 8,500 people were killed. You can see, when I left Rwanda in 1996, I did not go outside as a tourist. I just went to seek asylum. So in Rwanda, unfortunately, things did not change immediately. And even now, I think we need to really sit down, talk about our problems, and through dialogue, truth, we reconcile and rebuild the country.
Is there any mechanism for doing that? Is there any way that people are talking? I mean, one thing we've observed is that there are a number of women have been elected to the legislature. Not that that's the sort of the panacea there, but there's a sense that perhaps they are more willing to set some of these rivalries aside.
Yeah, well, bringing up women in the parliament, that is a very good idea. But were they elected? They were just nominated. Who just chose them? The president himself. He's choosing who he wants to do what he wants. So there is no free election in Rwanda. For instance, the president himself was elected at 95% point something. Can you imagine that happening in the United States?
In fact, you have some strong words toward the end of your book about the current president. You've called him a classic African strongman. And he has some rather strong words for you, too. He has said in interviews subsequently he says that you took money from the refugees. He said that you had little to do with the actual release of the refugees who were staying at the hotel. Why is he saying these things, and what is your response to these things?
I think that from the day I was received at the White House last year, Mr. Kagame, felt threatened. And when the movie came out and was shown in Rwanda in April last year, he was much more threatened. That is when he spoke for the first time about myself and called me a Hollywood-made hero. That is what he talked about during the 11th commemoration of the genocide on April 7th, 2005.
And for those who have any lingering doubt that who have heard these allegations that you took money from the refugees, what your response is?
Actually, Hotel Rwanda does never show. I knew that the government was going to do this, absolutely. Hotel Rwanda does not show a hotel manager who does not receive payments from the guests. You have seen for the first time a manager does not run after client customers to make them pay. But you saw the manager in Hotel Rwanda himself distributing bills to people, asking them for payment, because I knew this was going to happen, and I asked filmmakers to earn that part of it so that it won't be new, so that there won't be any discussion about this.
Do you find these allegations painful?
Well, they are not painful to me. I would like to see the president himself talking about me every day.
Okay. Let's go to Florida and Jenny. Welcome, Jenny.
Hi, first of all, you're just a true inspiration to me. And my question is, my cousins are two lost boys from Sudan, and I was just wondering, I know you've set up something, a relief for the orphaned children in Rwanda, and I was just wondering how you did that and what it's about.
In 1994, immediately after the 100 days, my wife, a friend, and myself decided to drive south and see what was remaining where we came from. We all of us come from the south. So when I arrived at my brother-in-law's home, one of my brother-in-law's, we noticed that he had been killed and one of his daughters was killed with my mother-in-law. But his wife had, my wife's sister had 8 children, other children. They were living in the rural area. She had 7 daughters and just a small boy, whom she was carrying in a bag, zipping in order to hide him, because killers were hunting for boys. I took my sister-in-law to Kigali, to my house in Kigali, and I went to stay as a diplomat with my wife and children, and she occupied our house. Then I had to create a job for her, and I also to pay school fees for her 8 children. She was new in the city, and she knew nothing. She had nothing to survive. So I had to create a job for her and pay school fees for her. A few weeks later, one of my wife's younger sister again came in from the Congo, where she had fled with others. She learned that we were still alive, and she came back. I also sent her to my house with her 3 sons. So then we had 11 children and their 2 mothers. That is how I started. And then as time went on, also my nephews, my nieces came seeking help for help. And that is how I started the Hotel Rwanda Rusesabagina Foundation. But it had started a long time before. Today, most of those kids are university students. And my foundation is helping paying tuitions for all of those young kids, helping all of those raped women, paying with the medical care, with the psychological follow-up, and everything. My own conscience advised me to do so.
Jenny, how are your cousins doing? The boys from Sudan. How are they doing?
One of them is doing really, really well, but the other one is he's having a rough time because he's in school right now, but he can't speak very good English, and so he's having a rough time with that, but they're really starting to fit in.
Okay. Jenny, thank you for calling us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You live in Brussels now. How do you support your family?
Well, when I left Rwanda as a refugee, I had no other alternative. I was lucky to leave Rwanda with a briefcase, with at least something. And when I left, I just had enough money to buy a cab, just one taxi. And I became a boss of myself. So I was driving my taxi myself every day, getting up at 5, making my coffee, driving my taxi all around Brussels until 7 p.m. And I did this for a year. After the year, I bought a second one. And 3 years later, I opened a trucking company in Zambia. And today, I own a trucking company. I'm moving around doing a lot of speeches. I'm a writer. I have written a book. So I'm busy, and also my foundation. So I'm busy.
How is your family?
Everybody is doing well. My two daughters are grown-ups. They are married. My elder daughter has got two daughters, and her sister has got a son. So everybody is doing well. The younger son is now in Southborough, not far from Boston, in a boarding school. The two nieces also, who are our daughters, are attending primary or secondary schools in Brussels.
Does he remember what happened? Your youngest son?
No, my youngest son does not remember what happened, because during the genocide, he was 1.5 years old. And his cousins also, my wife's two nieces you have seen, they were babies. The elder one was just 2 years, and her sister was 9 months.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Do you still have dreams about what happened?
I used to have dreams and nightmares, but since I started talking about the Rwandan genocide on such a large scale every day, I believe that the best therapy in life is to talk, to share with others, and this is what I have been doing.
And you never find it painful?
Well, it is always ever painful. And you know that even if I followed Hotel Rwanda when it was being made from the beginning to the end, even the production side of it, I followed it in London. But whenever I see it, it is always fresh in mind. I always take at least 15 minutes to come back to myself.
I'd like to go to Columbus, Ohio. And John? John,
yeah,
welcome.
Hi.
John, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, what's on your mind?
I just want to ask my brother what they do in Rwanda now. Are they do reconciliation, or they let themselves, the Holland dictate for them to take the people who are responsible for this crime to court or wherever?
Unfortunately, we replaced a dictatorship by a dictatorship. The kind of reconciliation, you can never reconcile people before you do justice. In Rwanda, we have almost 100,000 Hutu prisoners. Hutus killed Tutsis during the 100 days from April the 6th up to July the 4th, when the rebels took over the country. But before the genocide, Tutsis on the hills were inviting Hutu men for meetings and killing them. They were inviting their young people, young sons, to join the rebels' army, killing them on the hills. If you go to Byumba and Ruhengeri in the north of Rwanda today, you will notice that 80% of the population are just widows without sons, without husbands. And that is why people were fleeing the rebels. And by 1993, we had about 1 million people displaced within Rwanda, surrounding Kigali, who had fled the zones occupied by the rebels. Those ones are not supposed to be punished, because they have been the winners. And the winner is writing history. And then after the genocide also, as I described, Tutsis killed Hutus. Those who killed are supposed to be killers as well. So all the killers are not being judged, are not tried, are not convicted the same way. As long as then justice is not being done, there won't be any true reconciliation.
John, thank you for calling.
Hello.
I said thank you for calling, John.
Well, I want to make a point, but I didn't get it done. If you
okay, well, briefly, if you would.
The point that I want to make is, when you start talking, you're talking about UN, international community. I think UN is there for the white people. It's not for the Africans or black people. The reason why I'm saying so is a couple of years ago, we saw South Africa. There's millions of people have been killed, but nobody has been called for trial. There's the international community, hey, wherever they are there, nobody called them for trial. Recently, they called Charles Taylor, which is president of the United States. He told Charles Taylor to go to exile without having any trial or problem. The man accepted that, and he went to exile. And right now, he called him back, go to trial, which is, there's no peace in Liberia now. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the international community is doing.
Okay, John, thank you so much.
They can't able to stop, but they can able to try them. I mean, what's the problem is that? They can't stop killing.
Okay, John, thank you so much for calling. But do you, what about John's point? Do you think that that's a widespread view? I mean, not that you, you know, you cannot speak for the continent, you cannot speak for a whole country, but do you think that there is a view in Africa, in the region, that, the UN really doesn't care about the problems of the region, that it's more European-oriented or somehow more interested in other parts of the world?
Actually, to me, the United Nations is a non-existing institution. Because it does know the United Nations are not doing anything, and especially when it comes to the peacekeeping side of it. But it will, and they are doing a lot of things, of course, in the other fields. But in the peacekeeping mission, they are not doing anything, especially when it comes to Africa. What happened in Rwanda in 1994? A million people were killed, approximately, let's say 800 or a million, were killed in 100 days. And a million meant, at that time, 15% of the population. So it was a million out of 7.5. 15% of the population killed, decimated in 100 days. Imagine if, for instance, the United States, you are born 300 million. Imagine if someone could come and kill 45 million people in 100 days. Do you believe that the whole world, the international community, would keep quiet and silent, stand by, watch?
Paul Rusesabagina's autobiography is called An Ordinary Man. He's a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the National Civil Rights Museum's 2005 Freedom Awards. He joined us in Studio 3A. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.